So, just picking up where I left off, our primary users are live streaming and web videos, so the video for this conference will all be available in Ogg Theora. We're also the primary media format used on websites such as Wikipedia, the 9th largest website in the world, and Metavid and a few others. You can currently, in order to deliver Theora in the browser, you have to use Cortado, this Java plugin, various other plugins like VLC, Zine, QuickTime, etc., or the new script we developed called MV Embed, which tries to manage all of these and figure out which one the user has installed already automatically. And hopefully we're soon planning to get native Firefox and Opera support, which will make this whole situation much, much easier as long as you're running a decent browser. So, the main block diagram for the codec, you start out with some input frames, you do motion estimation, so this is going to try to remove the temporal redundancy between the frames, and you run it through the discrete cosine transform, which tries to remove the spatial redundancy between the frames, and then the quantization and tokenization algorithm. So the quantization is the only lossy step in the entire process, so this is a lossy codec, it does throw away information in order to get better compression, but hopefully it's not too visible. And from there, it goes into entropy encoding, which is a lossless compression process, and then down in the decoder, it goes through essentially the reverse of all of those operations. The decoder also has an extra step at the end, the loop filter, which tries to remove blocking artifacts introduced by this whole process, and the output of the loop filter is fed back into the motion estimation stage. On the decode side, so the encoder here actually implements most of the decoder just to make sure that it uses the same reference frames when it's doing all of its prediction. On the decode side, you can do additional post-processing that's not in the loop, not in the prediction loop, and then eventually display the frames. So we're going to try to talk about all of these pieces. But first, I want to give a brief introduction to video structure and discuss some terminology, so when I mention all of these things, you'll have some idea what I'm talking about. So the first idea is the color space. So this is actually turns out to be fairly important from a compression standpoint. The main color space used by almost every video codec is formally called Y' CBCR. The first channel is Luma, and the other two channels are Chroma. And so the Luma channel roughly corresponds to grayscale. It turns out that humans have very good spatial resolution in their eyes when looking at grayscale images, not so much as chroma. So you can do a lot of things to chroma that you can't do to Luma in terms of compression. The Luma channel is nonlinear, so it's not gamma-corrected. The idea here is that intensity levels near zero are much closer together than those near 255. So very dark things, you have finer shades of gray than you do near very bright things. And this is actually the way that the human eye works. The actual exponents involved are not exactly the same between your monitor and your eyes, but it's close enough that it's useful to make sure that it's done this way. There's also some headroom. So this was originally done for analog signals, and so pure black is down at 16, and it turns out the chroma channels are actually signed, so it would be 16, 128, 128 would be pure black. And then the upper end of the range is the Luma channels up at 219, and the chroma channels go to 240. And that's just to give you some room at either end of the scale for signals to overflow. This turns out to still be useful in a digital standard, because when you do quantization, when you reconstruct your signal, you can actually sometimes overflow these bounds anyway. So how do you convert from RGB to this space? It turns out there's several different standards. There's NTSC and PAL and all of those wonderful things, and CCAM if you want to get really exotic. And so those details I'm just going to leave to the Theora specification if you're really interested. So there's also the pixel format. So most video is what's called 420. The idea here is that the two chroma planes are subsampled by a factor of 2 in each direction. Now, why do you call it 420? The name actually comes from the signal bandwidth ratios in the original analog standards. And so this has been done in analog television since it was originally developed. The way this works in Theora is basically you have a group of four pixels in your Y prime plane that corresponds to one pixel each in the CB and the CR plane. And the CB and CR plane, the actual sample location of that pixel is centered between the original four locations. And there are actually different standards. MPEG does that a completely different way, and it makes lots of problems when you have to mess with interlace video and all of that. This is the way that JPEG images do it, and so we went with that standard. It's reasonably simple for doing reconstruction. So, picture size. All our frame sizes have to be a multiple of 16 for reasons that will become clear as we get deeper into the codec. Now, your video input may not be a multiple of 16, so we handle this by having a smaller picture region that's defined in the header, and when it's displayed, it just crops the image down to that region. And so we assume that all the useful content is inside the picture region, and the other stuff outside can actually be completely arbitrary. And we're going to divide each frame up into blocks and superblocks. So the blocks are these little things down here. They're 8 by 8, so 8 pixels by 8 pixels. And we group 4 blocks by 4 blocks into something called a superblock, and those tiled a single color plane. And so if the frame isn't exactly a multiple of 32, which is the size of a superblock in pixels, it kind of hangs off the end there, and those blocks are just undefined. And inside of a superblock, blocks are coded along what's called a Hilbert curve. So the main idea here is this is a fractal space-filling curve. So it fills a 2D area, in this case the 4x4 area of the superblock. But each block is adjacent to the next block. So there's high spatial correlation between the blocks. You don't skip from one part of your superblock to another one as you're following this path. And that's because your pixel data is going to be highly spatially correlated. And so we want to take advantage of that in the codec as we're writing things linearly one by one to the file. There's also structures called macro blocks. So superblocks, they're all contained within a single plane. So it's 16 blocks from one color plane, and each color plane has its own set of superblocks. Macro blocks, on the other hand, cut across all three color planes. And so information which we want to store that's common to all those planes will be associated with a macro block. Right, yes, the super blocks are 32 by 32. And so your macro blocks are just 2 by 2 arrays of blocks, which is basically the smallest unit that ensures you also have a full block in the two chroma planes. And so they're 16 by 16. And we're going to require that the frame be a whole number of macro blocks. And so that's the reason for the frame size restriction. So there are also several frame types. So Theora is fairly simple. It only supports two. There's the intraframes, which do not use motion compensation. So you can decode an intraframe entirely by itself. They're also called keyframes, and in Theora they're called golden frames, which was terminology created by ON2, which will be used periodically. The other type is interframes. So interframes do use motion compensation. And the idea is you want most of your frames to be interframes because motion compensation helps you reduce bitrate by a significant amount. And so the only reason you would stick keyframes in there is because you want to be able to seek into the middle of the stream or start decoding from a stream that you've started downloading in the middle or something along those lines. And that's what you can start at an intraframe and go forward. But interframes cannot be decoded unless you have the previous frame to work from also. Yes, scene changes are typically intra just because that's the point where you don't have a lot of gain from doing the motion compensation. So yeah, you try to stick all your intra frames on scene changes. Sometimes there's still a small amount of gain to get, and so you may not necessarily put one in an intra frame, but... So in order to decode the current frame, you need the previous frame and the golden frame, so the previous keyframe. Those are the only ones you need. But to get the previous frame, you need the one before it. And so, yeah. If you have the previous frame cached somehow, then you can start and decode just one frame, but in order to get the previous frame, you had to have decoded all of them. All right, so now I'm going to talk about motion compensation, and I'm going to try to do both the encoder side and the decoder side together. They're very much related, and for time reasons, I don't want to spend too much time on the decode side. So, motion compensation. The main idea here is that video changes slowly over time. You have something that goes at 30 frames a second. Most of the stuff isn't moving. If it is moving, it isn't moving very far. And so, by subtracting out the previous frame, after compensating for any motion that has happened, you can remove a lot of the information that was in the current frame. And so we'll store a motion vector with every macro block that points to the piece in the previous frame that we want to subtract out. And so the basic idea here is you take this input, you compute some motion vectors and subtract off the reference frame, and you get a residual that contains much less information. So you can see the camera was panning down, so there's a lot of error up at the top there. But throughout much of the frame there, a lot of the detail is gone. And that's just that much information that we don't have to actually store. It's important here that when you're doing this, the reference frame you use is actually the same thing the decoder will see. So you use the decoded copy of the previous frame. Because otherwise, they'll be mismatched, and your error will drift and accumulate over multiple frames. And that would be bad. So the first thing you want to decide is whether or not we actually want to code a block at all. So not coding a block uses very few bits, because you didn't code anything. So the majority of compression in static scenes, like head and shoulder, teleconference type stuff, is actually achieved from just completely skipping blocks. When you skip a block, the frame data is just copied directly from the previous frame. It's the same as if the motion vector was 0, 0. And you don't send any error signals. You don't send the residual part. So if you can identify which blocks you want to skip early on, you can actually skip the entire motion compensation and save processing time too. So the current encoder uses a very simple change thresholding, so it just looks at the two blocks and says if they're sufficiently close together, then we just will skip that block. You can probably do smarter things that actually take things like the current bit rate into account and things like that. But we haven't gotten there yet in our software. So, however, you do have to code which blocks you're going to skip and which blocks you're actually going to code. And so how do we do that? We use run length encoding and variable length codes, which I'll now describe. So, which blocks are actually coded are highly spatially correlated. So large regions of the background that aren't moving will all be next to each other. All those blocks will be next to each other. Large foreground objects that are moving will also all be next to each other. So what we want to try to do is we want to mark an entire superblock at a time as either coded or not coded. So if all of the blocks in the superblock are coded, we want to just encode one bit that says, yep, they're all encoded or not. If none of them are encoded, we want to do the same thing. If some of them are, we want to encode some of them and not some of the others, then we follow this Hilbert curve. And so the idea is that hopefully all the ones that we want to code will be next to each other, and all the ones we don't want to code will be next to each other. And so the Hilbert curve will hit large runs of the same value when it's traced through that superblock. So this is actually encoded in the bitstream in a three-phase process. Each one of these is basically going to try to partition a bunch of objects into two sets. So the first one, we want to partition all of our superblocks into the ones that are partially coded, so some of the blocks are coded and some of them are not, and all the rest. In our second phase, we want to partition just the rest, and all the things that are either fully coded or not, into those two cases. And then finally, we want to partition the blocks that were only the ones that were in the partially coded superblocks into which ones are coded and not coded. And so that way we can reconstruct whether each individual block is coded or not, while trying to take advantage of all of this spatial correlation. So each partition is going to be represented using a bit string, and we're going to encode that bit string using run length encoding with variable length codes for the run lengths. So basically, you're going to code just the first bit value of your bit string, and then the run length. And then the next bit value is going to be the opposite bit, so you don't even have to code it. You just encode the next run length, and so on until you've reached the end of your bit string. And each run length is encoded with one of these variable length codes. So there's one for super blocks and there's one for blocks. The one for super blocks, you can see for each run length, there's a specific code that has, you know, some number of bits. And the idea is that you can just read off those bits until you figure out which code it is, and then read off your run length. And as you can see, for many of those long runs, you start to get some significant compression ratios in the length of your bit stream. Now, for runs of length 2 to 3, you can do a little bit worse than your original length. The idea is you want to have long runs, and so you're assuming runs of length 2 to 3 won't be that common. So there's no way you can design a code that gives you compression for every possible length. So the implication here is that you'll have more long runs than very short ones. For block flags, we know that we're coding super blocks where some of the blocks are coded and some of them aren't. So the longest possible run you can have is 30. And so when we design our code, we explicitly design it so the longest possible run it can represent is 30. And that helps get a little bit better compression. So now that we've decided which blocks we're coding and which blocks we aren't, we have to do a motion search for all the blocks that we are coding. So the main goal is to identify the best motion vector. What does the best mean? It turns out you can trade off how good of a match you find in the previous frame against how expensive it is to signal what that motion vector is. And so different motion vectors will cost a different number of bits to encode. And the best way to go about optimizing this is something called rate distortion optimization. And so your cost function is going to be a distortion term plus a scale factor times your rate term. And so the scale factor, lambda, is the number of bits you're willing to spend for a unit decrease in distortion. And roughly, if you pick a fixed value of lambda for a frame, it's roughly equivalent to a constant quality. It's unfortunately not equivalent to a constant bit rate. So if you're trying to encode a constant bit rate file, you have to estimate a value of lambda for every frame you encode. There are processes to do this, and that's more complicated than I want to get into in this talk. But the current encoder actually just uses distortion in many places. It doesn't pay attention to the rate at all. And this is suboptimal. Rate distortion optimization was not, the benefits of that were not commonly understood when Theor or when VP3 was first developed. And so it was not as prevalent everywhere as it is today. Most modern codecs will always use rate distortion optimization. And we're currently in the process of fixing that. So Monty has a new Fresnelda branch of the Theor encoder that's incorporating some of these improvements, and we hope to be able to release a new mainline soon that works much better than the current one. So how do you measure distortion? Measuring bit rate is easy. You can just count the number of bits. But how do you measure distortion? For motion compensation, the common metric is this thing called sum of absolute differences, which is basically just subtract the two blocks and add up the absolute value of all those things. And so a lot of people will say, well, why don't you use the square or so on? And the reason you use this has to do with the statistics of your frame difference. So this particular error metric implies a distribution of how your errors are going to be that matches much better with real data than a sum of squared errors or something along those lines. Typically, we measure distortion only in the luma planes. We completely ignore chroma. And that's because when you're doing motion estimation, you know, mainly you're trying to line up the hard edges and the texture detail. And you can get that just by looking at the grayscale image without paying any attention to what the color looks like. So we have to do a lot of motion searching. So we have two reference frames to check. We can refer to both the previous frame or the golden frame, either one. and that's per macro block. Plus, there's a special macro block mode which actually encodes 4 motion vectors, one for every Luma block. And so we also have to do a motion search for each block. The particular motion vector range, Fiora supports half pixel resolution. So there are 63 possible values for each coordinate, or 63 squared possible motion vectors. And the motion, or the error signal when plotted against your motion vector is very jagged and has lots of local minima. So there isn't a good way to do any kind of gradient descent or anything like that that would let you only check some of the values. So one thing people do is to first find the best full pixel value and then refine it to half pel. So that immediately cuts out a quarter of your points that you have to search. And that's because when you do the interpolation for half pixels, it actually does start to look somewhat smooth, and you can do just a little local search around there. So a full search is very, very slow. It uses nearly 500,000 pixel references per macro block to look at every motion vector and compute a SAD value for the whole block. So what the current Theoric encoder does is it starts to start with a logarithmic search. So it looks at, you know, plus or minus 8 pixels around, and it picks the best one of those, and then it looks plus or minus 4 pixels around that, and it picks the best one of those, and so on, down until it gets to half-pel resolution. And that requires roughly 16,000 pixel references, which is a heck of a lot less than 500,000. However, it's not always as good at actually finding a good motion vector. And so if the error returned is high, it'll back out and go do a full search, which is very slow. When you're trying to reference stuff outside the frame? Well, so the data you're pulling in from the previous frame can come from different macro blocks. And so, I mean, it can span macro block boundaries, and that doesn't matter. Outside of the frame, they just repeat values until you get to the maximum motion vector length. And a better approach is to do predictive search. And so all of these motion vectors are highly correlated because, you know, a large object when moving, all the pieces of the object move roughly the same rate, or at least, you know, depending on your perspective distortion, you're relatively close to the same vector. And so if you look at your neighboring blocks in both space and in time, so the motion vector you computed in the last frame and the motion vector you computed from the blocks immediately surrounding you, you can get a much better idea of which motion vector to check. And if you get a good result, there's no need to check any of the other ones. And so predictive search can actually, with just 3 or 4 SAD computations, return a very good motion vector that, you know, has very small performance degradation from doing the full search. And this is what we've tried to work into the Fosnella branch, and hopefully will be released soon. And that's, again, you know, almost 16 times faster than the logarithmic search, and actually performs better. So once we've done the full search, or the full pixel search, we need to refine to half pixels. So most codecs implement half-pel motion vectors by averaging 2 to 4 pixels. So just doing linear interpolation between the pixel values that you actually have data for. The problem is linear interpolation suffers from aliasing near edges. And so, you know, the Nyquist sampling theorem says, you know, you can only have a signal bandwidth that's, you know, half the sampling rate you have, and edges require an infinite bandwidth because they're a sharp discontinuity. So you have these aliasing problems. It turns out that the aliasing error is actually at its maximum right at the halfway point where we're trying to sample. But most codecs use linear interpolation anyway. It was kind of a holdover from the original MPEG-1 and MPEG-2 codecs. MPEG-4 actually supports quarter-pel motion vectors and does all this effort to do anti-aliased filters at the quarter-pel locations, but at the half-pel they still do linear. to be backwards compatible with MPEG-1 and MPEG-2, even though it's the worst place to do linear. So in Theora, you know, at least if you're going to do something that doesn't perform very well, I mean, it's very fast to do linear, but we can actually make it even faster because we're only going to average two values. It doesn't, you know, the jump from 2 to 4 when you're pointing exactly in the middle between 4 pixels doesn't really give you that much advantage over just averaging two of them. So the basic cases are listed here at the bottom. You can see as your vector points up in that direction, it's going to average the 2 pixels, the 2 pixel values roughly along that vector. Now, so Theora does not support motion vector resolutions finer than half a pixel, but our chromoplanes are subsampled. So if we have a half PEL resolution vector in the luma plane, at the chromoplane it's going to be quarter PEL resolution when we convert things to use the same units. So how do we handle this? What Theora does is just rounds the motion vectors so that any non-integer value is all treated as 1/2. So a quarter, a half, and 3/4 are all treated as 1/2. And so the basic idea is if your luma vector is going to average two values instead of just using one pixel value, then so will the chroma vector. And the reason for this is that the averaging process helps suppress noise introduced by the lossy encoding. And most of the benefit of using half-PEL resolution actually comes from this noise suppression and not the ability to encode finer resolution motion. And so that's part of the reason that Theora can get away with just doing 2 pixels in the averaging, because it's not the actual interpolation quality that matters so much as the fact that you're suppressing this noise. So after we've done motion search, we have to figure out how to actually encode what the motion was. And this starts out with macro block modes. So for each macro block, we're going to make a decision on how the motion for that is encoded. And there are 8 choices. The first one, intra mode, basically says we're going to do no prediction. So the motion search failed. It would be better off to just encode the values directly without bothering to subtract off the value from the previous frame. And so that happens sometimes when things pop up in your video, et cetera. It's generally not too common in intraframe. Then there are a bunch of modes which all use the previous reference frame. And finally, a couple of modes which can use the golden reference frame. And so the mode is going to determine which reference frame to use. So on the ones that use the previous reference frame, there are the no MV modes, which basically do not encode a motion vector. And so the motion vector is implicitly assumed to be 0, 0. This is roughly like skipping a block in not coding it, but we're also going to recode an error residual. So there's some chance that even if the prediction wasn't perfect, we can encode, spend some more bits to fix it up a little. There's the last modes, last and last two, which copy the previous motion vector, and last two copies the second to last motion vector. And so as I said, motion vectors are highly spatially correlated, and so you'd expect to see long runs of a couple of the same motion vector in a row, or vectors nearby that one. And so that's what last and last two are designed to handle. This is actually the only advantage Theora tries to take of motion vector correlation. More modern codecs tend to try to do median filters and other things across that, which in general can work a lot better, but are patented. And so the VP3 developers had to avoid them. And finally, there's this 4MV mode, which codes a separate motion vector for each luma block. And that's when, you know, if you don't have a 16 by 16 region that's all moving in the same direction, such as near the edge of an object, this can help out a lot. That's also used relatively rarely, but when it is used, it gives you a significant gain. So how do we decide which of these modes to use? So the current encoder just checks for the distortion for the cheaper modes that don't require you to send too much information. So for example, the no MV modes, you know, 4 motion vector mode is requires you to send 4 motion vectors, which winds up being a lot of bits. And so you don't want to use that one unless you really have to. So if the distortion is below a threshold, it won't even check that. It turns out it's much better to use rate distortion optimization to tell you which one to use. Problem is, what do you use for R&D? And so the real answer you want is to code that mode and the motion vectors and all that associated information plus the cost to code your error signal, the residual, the part that you couldn't predict with motion compensation. Now you could apply all the subsequent steps. So you do the transform, you do the quantization, you do the entropy encoding for every choice and check them all, but that would be far too computationally expensive. Even if you did that, the way that Fiora entropy encoding works, you can't really figure out how many bits a given block is going to take until you've transformed and quantized the entire frame. And so if you wanted to do that, you would have an exponential complexity because you'd have to try all different possible combinations of modes for all of your macro blocks in a frame to find the real true optimum. That's clearly out the window in terms of computation. So instead, what we're going to do is just going to look at the error after motion compensation and try to estimate what the error after the complete encoding and what the bit rate required after the complete encoding process is. And you just collect a bunch of statistics from lots of video and say, you know, if my error after motion compensation looks like this, R&D look like that. And that actually turns out to work fairly well. We've gotten about a 5% improvement over what the current encoder is doing just by that change. So how do we code these macro block modes? It turns out Fiora uses a fixed code, so all the code words are going to be the same, but a dynamic alphabet. So the encoder is going to choose which mode corresponds to each code word in our code. There are six standard lists, or the encoder can explicitly send the list of this macro block corresponds to the first code word, this macro block mode corresponds to the second code word, and so on. It turns out that last one is the one that actually gets used most often. So the six standard lists don't actually match up very well with the way most video works. But I'm not sure if any six would if you really picked them. I think there's more variance than that. So those, once you've assigned which order the modes appear in, they're encoded with a very highly skewed variable length code. So it goes all the way from a code word that's just 1 bit long up to a code word that's 7 bits long, which is a heck of a lot longer than it would take to do 3 bits to just encode one of the possible 8 values for the macro block modes by itself. And so sometimes this variable length code will actually be worse than just doing 3 bits by itself. So it has a special fallback mode that says, just encode the 3 bits. So after you've encoded the macro block modes, you know how many motion vectors to send for each macro block. So every macro block gets between 0 and 4, depending on the mode and how many coded Luma blocks. So if you have a 4MV mode, but you only encoded 3 of the Luma blocks, you only send 3 motion vectors. The Luma block you didn't encode is assumed to have a motion vector of 0, 0. And these are coded with a fixed variable length code. I'm not going to reproduce the full thing here because it doesn't fit on the slide. But you basically see the range of values, how many bits it takes to encode each one. So you can see as you get larger and larger motion vectors, it requires more and more bits to encode them. This can have the same problem as encoding the macro block modes, that if you encode, it might require more bits to use the variable length code than if you had just written out all the motion vectors explicitly using 6 bits per component. So as a fallback, it allows you to do that. So that was the entire motion compensation process. Now we want to do the transform coding. So we've removed temporal correlation. We now want to remove spatial correlation. So the tool that does this is called the discrete cosine transform. It's an approximation of this ideal transform called the Karhunen-Loev transform, which hopefully I pronounced anywhere near correctly. The basic idea of the KL transform is that you compute the eigenvalues, eigenvectors of the covariance matrix of your pixels, project the data onto those eigenvectors. So this is a basic statistical tool called principal component analysis. And but in order to do that, you need enough data to estimate the covariance. So we want to project the data inside a single block. We need lots of blocks in order to estimate that. And a single frame's worth of blocks may not be enough. You also would need to send the eigenvectors, which can actually be larger than the original amount of data you had. So that's not going to be very helpful for compression. It turns out that the discrete cosine transform comes close to the KL transform for natural images. And so just the way that pixels are organized in the common scenes that you see happens to match up closely with the discrete cosine transform. So this transform is applied to each 8x8 block. It's the primary reason that we split things up into 8x8 blocks is because that's the size of our transform. So it's a separable transform, so you can apply it in one dimension along each axis independently. So in one dimension, it's essentially a matrix multiply. So your output vector y equals this matrix g times your input vector x. G is an orthogonal matrix, so it essentially acts like an eight-dimensional rotation. And the basis functions of that rotation are here at the bottom of the slide. The first one is called the DC component. And you think of electric signals, it makes a lot of sense. The DC component is constant, and it acts as essentially an average of all of the pixels in the block. All of the other coefficients are called the AC coefficients. And so those signals alternate in waves at varying frequencies. So as you go up in coefficient number, the frequency of your wave gets faster. So in two dimensions, you first apply the transform to the rows, and then you apply it to the columns. And this just looks like two matrix multiplies. So x is your 8x8 matrix of pixel values in the middle, and y is your output 8x8 matrix of DCT coefficients. And you just apply this transform on both sides. The basis functions in two dimensions look like this. And so you can see up at the upper left, you have your DC coefficient, which is constant, and then waves in the horizontal direction across the top and waves in the vertical direction across the bottom. And as you go towards the lower right corner there, they mix together and get waves in both directions. And so you're trying to represent your signal as linear combinations of these basic shapes. And one of the things you'll notice is that there isn't really a good basis function that looks like a hard edge. And so if you have a hard edge in your image, it will actually give you responses. You know, for example, say you had a hard vertical edge, it would give you responses all across those top coefficients and require lots of bits to encode. And that's one of the primary problems with transform codecs, is because when you start introducing quantization error into here, if you have a hard edge next to a very smooth region and you make it an error when encoding it because you've thrown away data, the length of your basis function that extends into that smooth region will start giving you non-smooth responses, and that causes ringing artifacts, which are one of the primary problems with block-based or any transform codecs. So in order to do this, you know, if you did it the naive way with two 8x8 matrix multiplies, it would be 1,024 multiplications and 896 adds, or about 16 multiplies per pixel. It turns out the discrete cosine transform is closely related to the Fourier transform, so there's also a fast decomposition, like the fast Fourier transform. So in one dimension, it takes only 16 multiplies and 26 adds. This is the basic network diagram of what that transform looks like. So each one of these little circles here is an addition, and the little constants next to each signal line are a multiplication of the line by that value. So if you count up all the constants, you get 16. And if you count up all the little circles in the line, you get 26. So if you apply that one time to each of the rows and then one time to each of the columns, 16 1D transforms. So the total cost for 2D is 256 multiplies and 416 adds. So it's about 4 multiplies a pixel. On your most resource-constrained devices, like embedded devices and such, the multiplies dominate the computation, so the adds aren't that expensive in comparison. So you really just look at the multiplies when looking at the costs. So just to give you an example, we start out with this input image on the left that I've shamelessly stolen from some MIT lecture notes. And you can see all of your data there is very highly spatially correlated. So the bright regions are all up next to each other in the upper left. The dark regions are all next to each other down at the bottom. And when you do the transform, you get a few large coefficients up on the left, and then mostly zeros. Now, this was a somewhat contrived example, so you get exactly zero on a lot of these things. In a real example, you just get values that were close to zero. And that's why we introduce the quantization step. So, the main idea behind quantization, designing quantization correctly, is to use what's known as the contrast sensitivity function. So, humans perceive contrast, or humans' ability to discern contrast, varies by the spatial frequencies. So, it'll look slightly different to you, but to me it looks like there's a hump up here, and it comes down over here, and you can start to see everything above that line sort of blends into gray, and the stuff at the bottom, you can actually see the waves. It turns out that all of these waves actually have the same amplitude across the whole image, across each row. And so that line you're seeing is the threshold between where you can actually perceive those changes in amplitude. So this is, quantization is actually the only lossy step in the entire process. Everything else is done losslessly. And if, in theory, if you skip this step, you could actually get lossless compression, though you may not actually wind up with less data than you put in. So the idea behind quantization is we're going to divide every coefficient output by our transform by a number that's chosen to roughly match this contrast sensitivity function. And so the example matrix that's actually used in the current encoder is given here over on the right. You can see in the upper left you have relatively small values for where people are more sensitive, and the higher frequencies where you're relatively insensitive, where the curve was low, you use larger values. But the contrast sensitivity function basically tells you where the threshold of visibility is. Once your bit rate drops down low enough that you know you're going to have visible artifacts, that people are going to be able to see them, the relative sensitivity between those artifacts doesn't really follow the contrast sensitivity function anymore. It's more evenly distributed. In fact, H.263, which was designed for internet streaming, used a constant quantization matrix. So every coefficient was divided by the same value. Things like MPEG-4 actually allow you to switch between one of these highly skewed matrices and the constant matrix, in which, you know, sort of handles the two extremes okay when you're trying to get transparent reconstruction and horribly lossy reconstruction, but doesn't really handle anything in between very well. And so what Fiora allows you to do is interpolate between these extremes. So when you're targeting a bitrate that's somewhere in between, you know, horrible postage stamp size web video and, you know, DVD quality, HD DVD quality, you know, clean images, if you're somewhere in the middle, you can actually get better performance by using a matrix designed for that situation. So one of the other things to notice is that our DC coefficient, which I said was just basically the average of the input pixels, essentially, if you put them all together next to each other, would look like a 1/8 resolution copy of your original image. So if it looks like the original image, it's just like the original image, going to have lots of correlation. So we use a simple filter which tries to predict the next DC coefficient from its surrounding DC coefficients. And this is basically just a weighted average of those surrounding coefficients. So the idea here is you're only going to use the preceding neighbors in raster order, not coded order. I'm not sure why that decision was made, but unfortunately it makes things a whole lot more complicated when you're actually doing your implementation. But you restrict the neighbors you consider to only those that were predicted from the same frame. So if you subtracted off a value from the previous frame in this block, and you subtracted off a value from the golden frame in the next block, you wouldn't really expect the resulting DC coefficients to be related at all. And so this one would not contribute to the prediction for this one. And your filter coefficients vary by the available neighbors. I'll refer you to the spec if you really care what they are. And then if you have no available neighbors, as a last resort, just use the last DC value with the same that came from the same frame, that was predicted with the same frame, as your predictor for the next DC value. And so we're going to subtract off that prediction on the encode side, and then on the decode side, you reconstruct that prediction and add it back. One of the features we added to Theora that was not in VP3 was this idea of per-block quantization. So you can actually signal up to 3 quantizers per frame. So 3 full quantization matrices, and switch between them on each block. This is useful for a lot of things. One of them is near sharp edges, as I talked about, where you have those extra coefficients. Sometimes it's worth spending extra bits to make those look better because they're extremely noticeable. Another is if you had regions with relatively few details, you might get away with using a lower quant or using a higher quantizer in throwing away more information. And there's also been experiments in the literature to try to divide the frame into foreground and background regions and spend lots of extra bits on the foreground regions and kind of throw away things on the background regions that you're not actually looking at. So you can pick one of these to use for all of the AC coefficients of a single block. You can't, unfortunately, use it for the DC coefficients because the DC prediction happens after quantization. So if you started throwing all of your DC coefficients around at different scales, they wouldn't be very good predictors anymore. So the DC coefficient is always quantized with the first quantizer in the list of possible choices. So once you've picked quantizers for all of the blocks, you actually code which ones you choose using the same run length encoding plus variable length schemes as we used to decide which you used to encode which blocks were actually going to be coded. So the same, you know, partition into the guys who use the first quantizer and the rest, and then you partition the guys who use the second and the third. So now the coefficients in a single block are scanned in zigzag order. And so this was introduced way back in JPEG compression. The main idea is that you're roughly moving from low frequency components to high frequency components. So you expect most of your energy to be in the first few coefficients in zigzag order, and most of the rest of your coefficients to be big long runs of zeros, which are easy to compress. So now we're going to take these coefficients and convert them to token values. So this idea of changing your coefficients, which are just a list of numbers, into some arbitrary set of tokens is fairly unique to Theora. It's not something you see in other codecs. Most of them just try to encode the coefficient values directly and the zero run lengths directly. The tokens are going to be 32 tokens available. Each one has a fixed number of extra bits associated with it. And so we're going to entropy encode the tokens, and the extra bits are just written directly. So the idea is there isn't very much to gain by trying to compress those bits. So the first kind of token we can talk about are end-of-block tokens. So an end-of-block token signals the end of the block. Basic idea is, if you hit one of those tokens, you assume that all of the remaining coefficients in the block are zero, and you don't have to decode any more tokens for that block. So you can also create runs of end-of-block tokens which through adjacent blocks. So if a whole bunch of blocks end at the same place, then you can encode all of that with a single end-of-block token. And the run lengths are, you know, each token value corresponds to a given set of possible run lengths. And the extra bits tell you, you know, allow you to differentiate between the run lengths for each token. So there are also zero run tokens. So this is a run of zeros that doesn't end the block. So it doesn't go all the way to the end, but it can still be a long run of zeros somewhere in the middle. the first two are your basic ones that have just represent zeros, so you can have a short zero run, which requires only a few extra bits to encode, and a full zero run, which can encode all the way up through the end of the block. And in the bit stream, there's actually no way to ensure that the zero run you decoded doesn't run right off the end of the block. So when you're writing your decoder, you have to be careful of malformed streams that could start overwriting your buffers and things like that. All of the other possible values are zero runs followed by very small coefficient values. And because most of your coefficients towards the end of your block are generally going to be small and you're going to be divided by a large number, they'll typically be zero, but sometimes you can get one that's just above the threshold. And that turns out to happen often enough that it's worth having special codes for a zero run followed by a small value. And so there are a number of different tokens for different possible run lengths of zeros followed by different small values. And finally, things that aren't zero runs, you can actually code a single coefficient by itself. And so there are a number of individual tokens for the very small values, which get used fairly often. And then each of the larger values, you know, requires progressively more and more extra bits associated with it. So the basic idea is the small values are cheaper to encode, the large values occur more rarely and require more bits. Now, the thing to note is that the way this construction works is that there's a maximum value. You can't encode a coefficient larger than 580, which means there's a minimum quantizer you can use. And so the current Theora format can't actually ever get to lossless reconstruction because of this limit on the minimum quantizer. So once you've gone through and tokenized all of these blocks, all of the tokens for a single coefficient are coded at once in order, in coded order, before moving to the next coefficient. The next coefficient means the next coefficient in zigzag order. So this basically means that all of your blocks have to be transformed and quantized before you can start entropy coding. This choice was almost certainly made to try to get around MPEG patents, which encode all the coefficients for a single block at a time. And unfortunately, it means that you have poor cache locality when decoding, because you have to go through all of these coefficients to figure out the DC coefficients to figure out what the first AC coefficient for the first block is. And so in order to reconstruct a single block of data, you've had to decode most of the entire stream. Now, the current decoder actually goes through a fair bit of effort to try to do this in a smart way, and it actually runs through all of the coefficients one time, runs through all of the tokens one time before converting them back into coefficients, and just finds out where the boundaries are between each of the lists. So it finds the end of the list of DC coefficients, finds the end of the list of the first AC coefficients, and then it goes back and decodes a single block at a time, just advancing the pointers into these lists. And so the idea there is that you can do most of your work on just these, on a block at a time, without having to decode the full amount of data. The original decoder would convert everything into coefficients, which was use much more memory than the tokens did, because the tokens represent zero runs, so you can represent lots of coefficients with a single token. So the way you handle tokens which represent multiple coefficients is that you code it when you would encode the first coefficient in that run. And then that block gets skipped in all of the subsequent coefficients until you've used up all of the coefficients that token represented. And that requires some fairly complex code to actually manage all of that. So how do we encode the token values? The token values are encoded using Huffman coding, which, you remember the Shannon source coding theorem says the best code for independent and identically distributed variables, and those two words are the keys there, with a given probability distribution, PI, uses the negative log of the probability of each symbol, bits, per value. And so when I say independent and identically distributed, we've done all of this work to try to remove correlation between our pixel values. That was the whole point of the DCT transform. And so if your variables are uncorrelated, then they're independent. That's that idea. And the hope is that coefficients, the same DCT coefficient in each block is going to have roughly the same distribution across all the blocks. So that's the identically distributed part. So this guy Huffman gave you an algorithm for translating these probabilities into what's called a prefix-free code. So the prefix-free means you can just start decoding, and as soon as you get something that you recognize as a code word, you know it's not also a prefix to a different code word. So you can immediately say, aha, that's the code word, and decode it. So it turns out that all of the codes that we've looked for, all of the fixed ones for encoding the variable length codes for the coded blocks, for the motion vectors, for the macro block modes, all of those were prefix-free codes. And so all of those can be related through the source coding theorem to an assumption about the underlying distribution of the values we were coding. That distribution may not always line up with what we actually observe, and that's why they had those fallbacks in there. It turns out there are better ways to try to have something in between the worst-case fallback and the aggressive assumption you made about these highly skewed distributions. But anyway, so the main idea here is that you want to encode frequently occurring symbols with fewer bits and only use more bits on the very rare ones. And that's how you're achieving compression. So the Ortiz-Huffman tables, they're actually stored in the header. So you can come up with a custom set of Huffman tables for every stream. It turns out the gain from this is actually relatively small. There's a tool in Subversion to do it, but it's not actually distributed with any of our releases. It's roughly on the order between 1 to 2%. But there are 80 possible codes to choose from, so 80 possible tables, and each one represents 32 possible tokens. And they're divided into 5 basic groups of 16 tables by zigzag index. And so there's one set of 16 tables just for the DC coefficient. There's another set of coefficients of another set of Huffman tables for the first 5 AC coefficients, and so on and so on. And so you can select the way they're actually, you choose which tables to use. You can pick one table from group 0 for the DC coefficient. And then you pick one table index, so one number between 0 and 15 inclusive, and you use that for all 4 of the AC groups combined. So the 4 corresponding tables in each of those 4 groups are all linked together. And you pick the table to use simply by counting up how many bits it would require and picking your best choice. Now, that one is relatively easy. You don't have to worry about distortion. It's the simplest optimizer in the whole codec. So that's basically all the tools you need to go through the full process. We've gone through the motion estimation, the DCT transform, the quantization, the tokenization, the entropy encoding, and on the decode side, you just run through all in reverse. So there's a couple of extra pieces here on decode side, and one of those is the loop filter. So the basic idea of the loop filter is we have this block-based codec, and we haven't done anything to try to make sure that the signal we encoded for one block matches the signal we encoded for the next block right adjacent to it in any way, shape, or form. So the loop filter is going to try to remove some of these blocking artifacts. Basically, all codecs before MPEG-4 Part 2 and earlier used this idea of post-processing. So it was an optional thing. It was enabled only in the decoder. And would try to smooth these out. It's fairly computationally expensive. But the idea is if post-processing actually makes the image look better, then if you can feed it back in on the encode side, you can get a better prediction and save more bits. The only problem is this expensive processing is no longer optional, so you're required to do it. It turns out that H.264 and other recent codecs have also added the loop filter, H.264s is actually much, much more complex than Theora, but is also not optional. So how the loop filter works, you basically run this small filter across each block edge. So you're going to multiply the pixel values spanning that block boundary by these three numbers, and you can actually just do that with additions because the numbers are small and fixed. And now you're going to adjust the inside numbers, the two pixels adjacent to that block boundary, based on the strength of this filter response. So you can see that this filter responds very high in a positive direction when you move from a dark value to a light value. And it responds very high in a negative direction when you move from a light value to a dark value. So your filter strength on the positive side is going to say you're going to try to damp down this value up to a certain point. And at this point you're saying, oh no, that value probably isn't an artifact, that's something that we actually encoded. And so you scale back the amount you damp down until it gets back to zero. And anything above that, you say it's probably really the actual signal and you shouldn't try to smooth out. And the same thing happens down here on this side. And once you've done that, you've got the fully reconstructed reference frame and you can feed it back into the motion estimation process and the motion compensation process on the decoder side. And so that's it. That is the end. Both the encoder and decoder, it feeds back in and becomes a new reference frame. In the decoder, you're ready to display it. You can do additional post-processing. So libtheora has some stronger deblocking and some deringing functions that try to smooth out those artifacts near edges. But those are much more CPU intensive than the simple loop filter that Theora has, and so they're optional. We actually even provide an API that lets you enable it now, which for many years we did not. Some of the future directions we want to go in, potentially an extension to the Theora or a new codec, one of these ideas is arithmetic encoding or range encoding. So the problem with Huffman encoding is all of your code words have an integer number of bits. And unfortunately, your probability distributions, your probabilities aren't always even powers of two. And so arithmetic encoding allows you to use a fractional number of bits. And this essentially gets you 6 to 12% fewer bits for free. The problem with arithmetic encoding was patented for many years. The main patent has now expired. There's still lots of patents on special cases and in hardware implementations and those things you have to be careful about. But the BBC is shipping Dirac with an arithmetic encoder, and we think you can too. Other idea here is overlap transforms. So this is similar to the MDCT, which is used in Vorbis in pretty much all other major audio codecs. And the idea of these overlaps is you have no blocking artifacts, so one block blends smoothly into the next. It can actually give you better energy compaction, so moving more of your information into a smaller number of large coefficients, than wavelets, while at the same time using less computation. There's if you have an overlap transform with no blocking artifacts, you need blocking-free motion compensation. So all of our motion compensation was just copying whole blocks. It turns out there are more advanced things you can do there, and that is an active area of current research. I presented some ideas about that at FOMS last year, if you were there. So, are there any questions? Yes. This is the only talk I have developed. It's actually really hard to find good information on the web. And if you come across something that helps you learn, please send it my way so I can point people at it, because that's a question I get a lot. Right, and it goes into the details a whole lot more, but some of it assumes you have some essential background, which hopefully this talk provided enough that you could now go read the specification and come away with an idea of exactly how things work.
So we can find this presentation document on the
website? On the website, so www.fiora.org. There should be a link on the front page.
I was just wondering if you really can't hear what it means, do the pictures come along the way being used, and how they compare with the world?
So we froze the bitstream back in Alpha 3, and all of this stuff is that we're talking about doing, except with the exception of the things on this last slide, are designed to be backward compatible. So everything I talked about in previous slides that we intend to do is all going to be backwards compatible. However, for a long time, we weren't shipping a decoder that was fully spec compliant. We are now doing that. We have been since, I think, either Alpha 7 or 8 or somewhere in there. And so those are all the decoders that can decode those are already moving into distros and will hopefully become fairly widespread available soon if they are not already. And so we expect most of those advantages to be available without anybody requiring to upgrade software, just upgrade the encoder.
So what you're saying is that the decoder will handle it, but the encoder is not enabling all the features or something?
Right. So for example, the per-block quantization is not a feature that's currently used by the encoder. We have some great ideas on how to use it. We know exactly where it will be really advantageous, but the code isn't there yet. However, it is there on the decoder side where it's much simpler. And so I have some experimental encoders that have made streams with using that feature just to make sure that all the bugs were worked out and such, but that code did not actually give very good performance, and so that's not really suitable for mainstream use. But we hope to release encoder that is and can take advantage of that feature in the near future, where near is hopefully within the next year or so. This is now that Monty is working for Red Hat full time and can actually spend significant amounts of time on this, that's going a lot faster. I unfortunately have a day job, and so my involvement has been less than I have desired.
Can you give some comparisons with other codecs in terms of aspects?
So with the current encoder, Fiora roughly corresponds to MPEG-4 Part 2 at low bit rates. We believe we can do better than that, and we also believe that at higher bit rates, we can come much closer to matching that. So that would be XVID or projects like that. We will probably never catch up to H.264 without doing some of these changes. And that's unfortunate, but that's the way it goes when you're trying to work around patents off of a very old code base.
So that means very large images or video are not so good. So whereas the smaller stuff you might see on a website or something is probably fine.
It's less an issue of the resolution as it is the bit rate for a given resolution. And so you can do HD Fiora. I believe it actually even decodes in real time now with something like a 1.8 gigahertz laptop or so, which is not too outrageous of a hardware requirement. But it's going to use more bits than H.264 at lower quality for that resolution. It will probably be comparable to MPEG-4 Part 2 or XVID. At higher quality, it's currently lagging behind somewhat, and those are problems we hope we can address. So the particulars around doing the half-pel motion compensation stuff make it not quite as compatible as you would like. So a quarter of your motion vectors can't quite be accelerated with the standard library algorithms. It turns out, if you're doing stuff like GPU acceleration, it works into there very, very well because the entire codec is based on integers. That's something that nobody is currently working on, but I think would provide a great deal of benefit for hardware acceleration if somebody wanted to dive into that area.
Yeah,
So Og Tarkin was a research codec that was started before Theora was, or before VP3 was open sourced and before the Theora project began. It was probably a little bit more advanced than the people working on it were ready to work through. It was doing 3D wavelets, which is actually, you know, even more complex than what BBC is shipping in Dirac. And basically, the people who had started it got bored and moved on to other things.